Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can. Because achieving your success is how Bloom Shapiro measures theirs. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. Larry Rifkin along with John Krofcik. And John, everybody has the idea of criminal justice reform on their minds. And now, of course, we're talking about some brutal events that we've seen in our country. Most of them, some injustice meted upon black males by our police officers. However, there have been so many inequities in our criminal justice system, and we had that podcast recently telling us that Democrats and Republicans, state by state, are revisiting a lot of their laws and how they determine who should be imprisoned and for what.
Well, I think with the protests and all going on, I think there's definitely a move to better what the police do and hopefully reform the courts and the justice system, because there's a lot of drug crimes. I'm a firm believer that the people who do drug crimes shouldn't really be in jail. I mean, that's more of a social issue, and we need to deal with that differently. So there's a lot of people in jail that shouldn't be there, I think.
Exactly. And there was this case that I've been following now in Colorado, and there was a young black man, 23 years old, and he was dancing to music that he alone could hear in his headphones, John. And this is before we were all wearing masks, and he was wearing a mask. Somebody called 911 and said, there's a guy acting strangely. He's dancing. He's moving around on the street. Three police officers answered the 911 call, and instead of having perhaps somebody there who was a mental health advisor or somebody who could just find out, hey, what's going on? Because even with the 911 call, they didn't suggest that he had done anything wrong to anyone. There was no criminality suggested, that he was just kind of an eccentric kid, perhaps, or somebody just in a good mood. He had gotten from a convenience store and had gotten some kind of a snack, and he ended up dying in the process of this exchange and encounter. And there's got to be a better way to handle these situations, particularly since he had no gun. He said he was a vegetarian to them, that he doesn't kill any animals. I mean, that he was just a normal kid, and he ends up dead. Yeah. How does that happen?
Yeah, I don't know. I know they're talking about a lot of police departments bringing in social workers
right, exactly.
To handle calls like that. So maybe we're on our way to a better world.
Yeah, why should we put that onus on police? I mean, oftentimes, as you know, they get into these domestic altercations, and they're ill-equipped to deal with the emotionality that's going on at that
Absolutely.
Time. But there are other people who are equipped to do that. So.
And a lot of times you don't even know who is right and who is wrong. You know, there's so much to sort out, and, you know, you got the adrenaline flowing. I kind of feel bad for police. You know, I feel bad for police. I feel bad for teachers. I think we really got a world that we really need to figure this out, what's going on. You know?
Well, I think we have to figure out that it's a lot more complex than we like to make it out. Oh, right. We'll send a policeman in, and he'll settle this.
Right.
Well, no, he's not really able to. And as you say, there's a lot going on between two people in a marriage or any type
right.
of relationship. Remember that old country song? We live in a two-story house.
Right.
She's
right.
got her story, and I've got my story.
Well, that's absolutely true. And you don't know where, you know, you don't know what kind of call the police was on before this. So, you know, there's so much that goes more into this that we don't hear about or see that that is really, it's a difficult job.
You're absolutely right. And I'll tell you, for many years, I think one of the things that we debated truly about the criminal justice system was whether we needed a death penalty, whether it was fair. And opponents of the death penalty, they argued that it's not a deterrent because most people who commit murder do so impulsively or in moments of passion or anger, that it endorses killing and brutality, and that we can get it wrong at times. And really, wouldn't you want to make certain that we as a society don't get it wrong? And then you had supporters saying, well, homicides committed impulsively are voluntary manslaughter, but the death penalty applies only to first-degree murder. But then we saw so many cases where it was the color of the victim, John, that determined whether somebody got the death penalty or even the color of the person who is accused. And if it was a white person, oftentimes the death penalty was meted out if they were the victim. So we've had a lot of injustice as to the way we've applied the death penalty. And then, John, we've had these interminable delays. So somebody goes on death row, and oftentimes they're ending up dying of old age because we have so many appeals. So the process just is broken.
Well, plus we come to the game with so many biases ourselves. Like, I think women don't get the death penalty as much as men do. And then I think, you know, people, blacks get the death penalty more than whites do. So there's a lot of inequity and a lot of, you know, I don't know how you get the biases out of the system, but they need to look at
that. Well, the one way to do it is just to abolish the system. Yeah. And in many states like our own, we've done that. Interestingly, when I was the head of programming at CPTV, we did a show called Connecticut's Death Row, and we looked at those remaining on death row at that time. And we actually interviewed the last person who was ever executed in the state of Connecticut. That was Michael Ross. You recall that name.
Yeah.
And he really said, I'm done. I did these things, and I want some peace. And he was the one who gave up all the appeals, or he'd still be alive today, clearly. Well, we want to talk about the death penalty. We have all heard about the Innocence Project, Just Mercy. Brian Stevenson has brought a lot of attention to it. So for this podcast, we're bringing you Brooks Emanuel. He's a legal counsel for the Justice Collaborative. Very interesting guy. And I wanted to get him to talk a bit about the federal death penalty, but he kind of moved me back toward more the state death penalties because that's where most of the people are still on death row. I think on the federal level, it's between 50 and 60 people, and we go back and forth between moratoria, where we don't do it. Then we have other cases, and they are allowed to go forward again. So it's always in a state of flux on the federal level as well, John. But a very interesting topic that I don't think a lot of us have been talking enough about.
No, not at all. I think it's good you brought this up. It's very interesting.
All right, the death penalty today on America Trends.
With me on the line on America Trends is Brooks Emanuel, and he's the legal counsel for the Justice Collaborative. And Brooks, why don't you take a moment and tell us about the Justice Collaborative?
Yeah, sure. And actually, I should say I'm a legal counsel, which just means I'm one of the staff attorneys who works there. But yeah, we are an organization devoted to ending mass incarceration. And a lot of our work is done at the local level. A lot of our work actually is focused on prosecutors. There's been a realization in recent years that prosecutors actually, you know, they weren't paid attention to for a while, but they actually have a great degree of power over the levels of incarceration in our country. As some people might know, the United States has the highest incarceration rate in the world. In about 30 years, we went from 300,000 people to 2.3 million people being incarcerated for a number of reasons that we'll talk about in this conversation. We have some policies like life without parole for juveniles that are exercised almost nowhere else in the world. So we have a really carceral country, and so our organization tries to work to turn that around by providing alternatives to incarceration or pushing for alternatives to incarceration, looking at the data around where and whether incarceration really helps and what other options you have for, you know, an easy one for a lot of people to look at, or a couple easy ones are, cash bail, for instance. In recent years, it's become pretty apparent that cash bail doesn't really make us any safer. What it actually does is incarcerate people literally for being poor. You can be charged with a minor crime and end up in jail because you can't afford to pay bail. You could be charged with a much more serious crime and get out because you have the money. And the use of cash bail has actually been shown to increase crime, make it more likely that someone will commit a crime later. So it's just a very backward policy. So that's one place we've done work. Drug offenses as well. There's a lot of evidence out of places like Portugal that you can have a much greater impact on reducing drug use and reducing crime by treating drug use as a public health issue instead of a criminal issue. And so we have been working on policies like that. We've been advocating for policies like that, as well as other things like not charging.
Well, it seems as if America is beginning to wake up and pay some attention to what it is that you're talking about. Even with a first start initiative within Congress, at least we're starting to move out of this punitive approach that we've taken. Having said that, it's really interesting because even when you watch these impeachment hearings of President Trump, you see all these Democrats and Republicans who announce that they're former prosecutors. And I didn't know we had so many prosecutors in Congress, mm-hmm. so I don't know what that does to affect their thinking. But why is it, when I grew up, I mean, Perry Mason, the defense attorney, was somebody we looked up to who would defend the innocent. And in the recent period, I'd say the last 20 years, it's been on the side of law enforcement, law and order, and all of these programs. And I know that might sound frivolous, but that's our popular culture. I mean, how much has that imbued the entire system with the whole sense that justice is in the hands of those who represent the state?
I think that's exactly right. And I think part of that is that it became politically expedient, you know, in the past few decades. You know, there was the Willie Horton ad against Michael Dukakis. There was the super predator language in the 90s about these roving gangs of super predator kids who were committing all these crimes, which turned out to be completely made up. The sociologist who even came up with that idea later said he was wrong. But it's a very easy thing, right? It's a very easy thing for politicians to run on fear. And so if you've got people scared of crime, and you can come in as the solution to crime by locking people up and imposing a more harsh penalty, imposing the death penalty, that sounds pretty good. The problem is that it just it leads to a lot of injustice, and it actually doesn't make us safer.
We're here primarily to talk to Brooks about the federal death penalty, and that's the reason that I contacted you, and you get into a multitude of other really fascinating issues. But let's fasten on to this issue of the federal death penalty, and if you could, give us a brief history of the federal death penalty and put it in the context of all death penalties, because in many states, including my own, we have rescinded our death penalty, and actually everybody on death row has now been commuted to a life sentence, and I know that's going on across the country. And I've got to tell you, in preparation for this podcast, I talked to a few friends, and they didn't even know we still have a federal death penalty.
Right, and I will be totally honest with you, Larry. I have much less familiarity with the federal death penalty because it has not been used as much in recent years. There was the recent push by Attorney General Barr to use it, which, you know, seemed to come out of nowhere, and unfortunately to me looks like it's a political move as well. And fortunately, the courts have said they cannot start using it again yet. My focus has been more on the use of the death penalty in the states, which is where it's had the most impact. And with our system of incarceration in general, it's interesting. You know, you're talking about the First Step Act at the federal level. And while federal law is certainly important, most people incarcerated, sentenced to death or sentenced to anything else in the United States are sentenced at the state level. And that's where most of my focus is, and I can talk about historically and where we are with that today.
Of course. No, I want to do that. But I know there are about 70 inmates who are on death row, and most of them end up in one place, the special confinement unit at the U.S. Penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana. But those crimes that fall under the federal, is that because somebody took a car across state lines? Of course, there could be terrorism, and we still have some detainees at Guantanamo. Who would fall under the federal versus the state? And if, in fact, a state doesn't have a death penalty law, that doesn't keep the feds from coming in under a U.S. attorney in that state, does it? And say that they cannot be prosecuted under the federal death penalty law.
Well, I mean, I think, again, I'm not as familiar with the federal law, but in general, there are times where you can be subject to both federal and state charges. So certainly, if there's a federal law in effect, that would overlap with the state law and the state didn't bring charges, that absolutely would not stop the federal government from coming in.
Okay. And by the way, I mean, and I will get to the state because that's where, as you say, this practice is much more prevalent. But I was also reading where nearly half of the federal death sentences are from only three states. I mean, that might shock people, Texas, Virginia, and Missouri. I mean, what does that tell us? It says to me that most judicial districts are not handing out the death penalty. And I'm wondering what that says about the movement toward more criminal justice reform, if it's being used almost disproportionately and inordinately in just a few places.
No, that's exactly right. That's a really good point. And that would be the case, you know, because that's consistent with what you see at the state level as well. You said half from three jurisdictions at the federal level. The vast majority at the local level, it's less than 2% of counties produced half of death row. The state,
really?
So literally
2%.
Yeah, half of death row, 2% of counties. I mean, it's just extraordinary. And in some cases, you'll have prosecutors who have you can look at their individual record. And that's part of, you know, the you know, I think you said Texas, Missouri, and what was your third state?
Virginia.
Right. And if you notice, those are all, now Missouri was questionable, but Texas and Virginia are certainly states of the former Confederacy. And it's really troubling if you look at a map of where death sentences, which states still use the death penalty, which states sentence people to death, and which states execute people. It lines up pretty closely with the former Confederacy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And a lot of that. Yeah, and so that's one of the really troubling things. So I think that, as you said, people would be really astounded when they find some of these things out. I think in tying the death penalty into criminal justice reform more broadly, it's a good way in for people because the stakes are so high, right? If you make a, quote, mistake with the death penalty, even if one believed that the death penalty were a useful punishment, you cannot undo that mistake. And so you have the regional, but when you look at how it is applied, it is not applied in any just or equitable way. You've already brought up the regional differences, which have a historical precedent. There are huge racial and class disparities that we'll get into. And then you end up as a result of that with a lot of people getting sentenced to death who are actually innocent. So, since 1973, which is the modern death penalty, which we'll talk about a little about what that means, you've had about 1,500 people sentenced to death. You've had 166 exonerations. So literally 166 people who went through our entire judicial process that we have deemed to be worthy to decide that we can kill someone have then been determined to be innocent, exonerated of all charges and set free.
And by the way, on the state level, and correct me if I'm wrong, in general, there are many more appeals that are available. So even if you go through all those appeals, all these other courts reviewing the initial trial court, and they got it wrong as well, I would imagine that many, even if they had public defenders, had a series of appeals that were promoted on their behalf.
Yeah, so that's a great – so that brings up two really important points. So one is going back to the federal issue. You had this law, you know, it used to be you had all your state level appeals and you had, you know, if the state, if you weren't able to get relief at the state level, which wouldn't be shocking, right? When you think about the apparatus of the literal state being used against you to get a sentence, once that sentence has been put into place, the state has a great incentive to keep fighting for your execution, because to do otherwise, they have to admit they're wrong, right? Mm. And so the federal courts, we hate to think of it like that, right? But that's what we have in our adversarial system. You know, you have the defense attorney supposed to defend you. But once you get convicted, you know, in the movies, you're talking about Perry Mason and everything, right? In the movies, this new evidence comes out that you're innocent, that somebody busts in the courtroom and everything's fine. In reality, once you're convicted and sentenced, it's very difficult. And so you have these appeals, but there are two things that happen. One, after 1994, we hear a lot about the crime bill, the Clinton era crime bill. It's come up a lot in presidential campaigns, and colloquially referred to as crime bill. The acronym is AEDPA. Lawyers generally refer to it as AEDPA, which is the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. It's a pretty interestingly named law. But one thing that law did was made it much harder to get into federal court. It created a much higher level of deference in the federal courts to the local courts. Mm-hmm. And so getting what's called habeas relief is much harder now. So that's one obstacle that limits the appeals. The other piece, and this is really where the class piece comes in, you don't get sentenced to death in the United States if you have money. It just doesn't happen. You get sentenced to death in the United States because you don't have a good lawyer to defend you. And that happens because you don't have money, either because you get a private or appointed lawyer in a place where, you know, some places don't even have a public defender. So you could get an appointed lawyer. Or in places that do have a public defender, I have tons of friends and colleagues who are excellent public defenders, but public defenders are stretched very thin, right? They're not funded well and they're stretched very thin. And when you think about everything that goes into a capital trial, you have to defend not only against the charges themselves, but then at the sentencing phase, you need to present evidence about why this person shouldn't have been sentenced to death. That's an immense amount of work. And if you don't have the money for a good lawyer, you may not do very well.
Well, back in 2000, the Department of Justice released a study of the federal death penalty system, and I'm sure that the inequities that they found could be found state by state, and they found tremendous racial and geographic disparities. We talked briefly about geography, but what's the racial composition of those on death row in America today? It would seem that on the federal level, two-thirds of the current federal death sentences that come from these three districts and three states, I think disproportionately have fallen to those who are African American inmates.
Right. Yeah. Over half the people on death row nationwide are Black, which is pretty astounding. When the population of the U.S. is what, around, I think, 15%
Black. Well, maybe even 12. Yeah.
Yeah. And so much of this. And half of them, likewise, half of the people that have been exonerated since 1973 are Black. So much of this goes back to the history of the modern death penalty, and the way that evolved as a tool, frankly, of white supremacy, is very related to the way that mass incarceration evolved as a tool of white supremacy. So if you go to the modern statistics in 1987, kind of jumping around a little bit here, but there are a couple things that can explain it, and then I can go back to the historical precedents. But there's a case that came to the U.S. Supreme Court called McCleskey v. Kemp. Did a very sophisticated study of the entire state of Georgia and showed that you were 1.1% more likely to be sentenced to death if you were Black than if you were white. And that's, you know, accounting for all other factors. If you line up similar cases next to each other. But the really critical difference was the race of the victim. And you were 4.3% more likely to be sentenced to death if your victim was white than if your victim was black. And so what that ends up meaning is you are most likely to be sentenced to death if you are black and your victim is white. And if we have time, we could, if I have time to go back to the way that this developed enslavement. Yeah, so this is, so I used to work at Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama, that's done a lot of work on this, defending people on death row and then tying it to the history of white supremacy in this country. And so what, you know, you have a death penalty during enslavement with some very explicit racial differences, right? So in some states, rape, you know, specifically by law, rape of a white woman by a black man is automatically punishable by death. Rape of a black woman by anyone was only punishable by fine. You know, very clear differences there. You have the end of the Civil War. And this is how you end up with the death penalty mostly used in the southern states. You have the end of the Civil War. You have a brief period of Reconstruction where you have federal troops in the South. The U.S. Supreme Court, or excuse me, the Congress passes a couple Civil Rights Acts. You have a brief period where we actually elect some black U.S. senators, some black U.S. representatives. Things look like they're maybe changing. For a variety of reasons, the Supreme Court kind of guts those Civil Rights Acts. The federal troops are pulled out of the South, and things quickly slide backwards. And what you have is a white populace in the South who has had this enslaved population that they could control. That control was built on this narrative of racial difference, right? You can't enslave an entire population of people if you think that they're just like you. And so they start looking for other ways to control that population and get back where they were. On the incarceration side of things, you see convict leasing. And so the 13th Amendment, as most of us here, quote, abolished slavery, but it literally says in the 13th Amendment, it abolishes slavery, quote, except as punishment for crime, right? That's literally in our Constitution, right? So we all learn about the 13th Amendment, and even that thing is kind of talked about as an exception, but it's right in there. So what you have in the South is this realization, oh, we can get back to slavery, basically. We just have to do it a little differently. So they pass laws that make it very easy to arrest black people because they're very discretionary. So they're like vagrancy laws, loitering laws. So you can literally arrest somebody for standing on the street. Oh, you're standing on the corner, you're loitering, I can arrest you. You convict them. Now, because of the 13th Amendment exception for punishment for crime, you can lease that person out to one of the former plantation owners or farmers who previously would have had them as a slave. And
wow,
so you have this.
I never knew that.
And it's really astounding. And so it's what's so difficult, I think, about our history in this country, right, is like most of us don't know that, but it's impossible to talk about where we are today if we don't know those things. So that happens. So, you know, there's one book called Slavery by Another Name. There's another one called Worse Than Slavery. And that's obviously a very, very careful saying anything was worse than slavery. But, you know, the idea there is that during enslavement, the people who were enslaving people had an incentive to at least keep them alive. When someone is being leased out to you, you don't necessarily. And so the level of brutality in convict leasing was just pretty astounding.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes us different. Our partners are true business advisors, listening, analyzing, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can, anticipating your future goals and drafting plans to make sure you get there. Because at Bloom Shapiro, achieving your success and satisfaction is how we measure ours. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
this modern era. We're with Brooks Emanuel, who's a legal counsel for the Justice Collaborative, and we're talking about the death penalty, the criminal justice system. How much is the movement toward criminal justice reform and the movement toward a greater sense that maybe this death penalty thing should be abolished, and we're seeing it state by state. Tell us how hand in hand these things are going forward.
Sure. No, that's a great question. And just tying one other quick historical piece, what you had with the modern death penalty is you had between the end of the Civil War and 1950, along with the convict leasing, you had over 4,000 African Americans lynched across the South. In the 1910s and 1920s, the states start to realize they're getting pressure at the national level to not lynch people, and they very actively switch to the death penalty. So they're on the floors of legislature saying we need to find a better way to do this. 1915, you see the first time that state-sanctioned executions outpace extrajudicial lynchings. Mm. Moving to the modern era, you've had some – there's a great question about the movement now, because – what you at first had were these really strong cases. In 1972, the death penalty, we thought, got struck down, excuse me, by the U.S. Supreme Court. A case called Furman goes to the U.S. Supreme Court. They show how discriminatory it is based on race and class. And the Supreme Court, in five separate opinions, there was no one opinion, but five concurring opinions, everybody says, two people say death penalty is unconstitutional, three people say, you know what, it's clearly we're not doing it right. It's discriminatory, and we can't let the states keep doing it. So some say it's discriminatory. Some say it's just arbitrary and freakishly imposed. In any sense, Supreme Court says no death penalty as applied. Everybody thinks it's over, but the states instead really want to keep executing people. They go back to the drawing board. They write new statutes that they say, you know, it'll really narrow our discretion, and we'll only execute the worst of the worst. They go back to the court in 1976, and the court says, great, you fixed it. We trust you now. You can start killing people again. Of course, what we have seen since then is just a total continuation of those disparities. And so in 1987, when I was talking about with McCleskey, they went back to the court and said, hey, you're 4.3 times more likely to be executed if your victim's black than if your victim's white. And unfortunately, the Supreme Court said, we don't doubt that, but there's nothing we can do about it. And the court basically expressed what the dissent found was a fear of too much justice, because they were not willing to take on these systemic problems. And so the movement since then has been more about chipping away. In 2002, we got a ruling, Atkins versus Virginia, that you can't sentence someone intellectually disabled to death. Until 2005, it was constitutional to execute kids. But in 2005, we were able to get rid of that. And so basically we've been stripping away at the procedures, and narrowing the people who can be sentenced to death rather
okay,
than going
but between the that, reinstatement right? of the federal death penalty that came on the heels of that 1987 ruling. So in 1998 and to 2019, there have been 79 defendants federally. Only three have been executed. I know that William Barr wanted to do more of it. In fact, I think there were five scheduled in this period, and they have all been held up. There's an injunction against them. On the state level, again, I live in Connecticut. We abolished ours just a couple of years ago. What is the movement there? How many states still have it, and how many don't have it, and how many are trying to expunge it? I mean, what do you see going on there?
Right. So you've got now 21 states have abolished the death penalty outright. Nine of those have done that since 2004, and I definitely want to give credit to the Death Penalty Information Center. It has great statistics on all these things if people want to look at them. 21 states have abolished it. 32 have not had an execution in 10 years. And so that's a great question about about how that plays into the movement to abolish it, because what you've seen with the Supreme Court, right, of course, you could have a federal law outlawing it. That seems unlikely. Or you could have every state decide to finally get rid of it. Or you could eventually get a U.S. Supreme Court saying it's unconstitutional. One of the things you've seen the Supreme Court do in recent years in its Eighth Amendment analysis, right? So Eighth Amendment is cruel and unusual punishment that governs the death penalty, like without parole, is they've looked at something called evolving standards of decency. And so in terms of the movement to get rid of these things, to get rid of some of these punishments, there's the cruel piece of cruel and unusual, right? But the U.S. Supreme Court has also honed in on the unusual piece and has made very clear, you can show us something is as cruel as you want, right? Like if you, you come up with some horrible punishment, but if everybody, every state uses it, we're not going to get rid of it because it's not unusual. And so what you have, if you're able to bring it down in terms of the number of jurisdictions using it and to show these things like it's actually only effectively coming out of 2% of counties, you're then able to make the case to the Supreme Court that not only is this cruel, right, in that it has a discriminatory function, it has an arbitrary function, there are parts of the method of execution, right, some of these lethal injection protocols that can cause a great degree of pain, not only is it cruel, but it is also unusual, and that's a way that you could eventually get the U.S. Supreme Court to find it unconstitutional.
And when I'm reading that, at least in the federal cases, they're trying to bring it down to one medication that would, execute an individual instead of this cocktail, and some saying, as you say, how extraordinary some of the responses of the body to it. I mean, is that one of the ways that they're trying to say we're trying to make it less cruel?
Yeah, you know, the lethal injection thing has been really interesting. What happened with that was there was a cocktail that was used for a number of years, and a few drugs, and then the maker of one of the drugs in Europe realized that this was what it was. It was never supposed to be meant for this. I don't even remember. It was a sedative or something. They realized it was supposed to be made. It was being primarily used for executions. And they stopped sending it to the United States. They said, we don't want to be a part of that. So the state started scrambling, to find other ways to do it. And so, yes, they are trying to say it's humane, but more troublingly, they've tried to hide it. So some states, including Georgia, where I live, actually passed a law saying that the state doesn't have to disclose like the specific drugs in the cocktail that it's using, because it would open them up to more challenges. And I think what it comes down to, you know, it's interesting. There was a lethal injection case called Glossop a few years ago where the Supreme Court basically said, we're not going to let you challenge. There was a challenge to the lethal injection protocol, and the challengers lost, and the execution protocol was upheld. And Alito wrote the opinion and basically said, if there is a way to, if the death penalty is constitutional, then there has to be a constitutional way to do it. And basically, you can't guarantee that death is going to be painless. So the lethal injection, there may be hope for that in the future, but that precedent from the Supreme Court makes it makes method of execution challenges a little bit trickier.
Now, when we look at the various concerns about the death penalty, I'll put them in four little buckets here. Racial bias, and you talked about that extensively. Wrongful conviction, and we know the Innocence Project has really helped out on that. Now we have much more sophisticated forensic tools. Soaring costs because of the appeals process, and disproportionate impacts on the most vulnerable. Do you think any of those are the compelling argument that one day the Supreme Court, now this Supreme Court is moving in a decidedly more conservative direction, and so I'm not certain when that day is, but do you think Do you think it's likely that one day the U.S. Supreme Court will strike all death penalties, state and the federal, down?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really, you know, when you put those buckets out there, I think they're all incredibly compelling. I mean, for me, I think the innocence piece is just kind of astounding to me, right? You have basically 1 in 10 people sent to death row to die are determined to be innocent. If you took a 1 in 10 error rate with anything else, like imagine if every airplane that took off, like 1 out of 10, everybody dies. That's literally what we're doing. We're just killing innocent people, 1 out of 10. So I guess I say that to say it gets really troubling thinking about what the Supreme Court is going to do, because I feel like that should be enough. Or likewise, the racial disparities should be enough. You know, this isn't exactly right, but Brian Stevenson, who runs EJI, talks about, you know, if Germany had a death penalty, which they don't, and if the vast majority of people on death row were Jewish, the world, it would be deemed unconscionable, right? But in the U.S., we have this extension of enslavement, we have a death penalty, and the vast majority of people there are black, and it's somehow okay. So, you know, I find all of those things incredibly compelling. And I think there was, as you said, it's moving in a conservative direction. There was some movement. There were dissents, I think, from Breyer and Ginsburg suggesting they were open to the idea that that the death penalty may be unconstitutional outright. With the current court, it's really hard to say.
He signed on to some criminal justice reform related to some low-level drug offenses, he's the one who came out and said that maybe drug dealers should be put to death. I mean, again, I'm trying to square how criminal justice reform, which seems to have support among Republicans and Democrats, why that doesn't trickle up, if you will, to the highest form of penalty, that being the death penalty, or ultimately, is that going to be part of the basket of reforms over some sweep of time?
I think that's a really great question. So I think that part of that is that part of the way we've gotten to criminal justice reform is this fiscal argument, right? And you brought that up, right? The expense of the death penalty, because it is actually more expensive to keep someone on death row and go through all their appeals than it is to sentence them to even life without parole. And I think that fiscal argument has gotten a lot of people on board with criminal justice reform that wouldn't have been otherwise. And then the problem with that is, in the short term, it's useful, but what it doesn't get to is what I see as the much bigger problem with our criminal legal system, which is the lack of humanity in it, right? So if you make it all about money, then it doesn't attack these places, this mentality that, oh, well, this person did this really bad thing, and therefore we need to punish them as harshly as possible. And I think that what we need to be doing is, in terms of reform, is, yes, the fiscal argument is important, but if we're really going to move the ball forward, and this is what a lot of the reform going on in the states is about, is really looking at what does it mean to lock someone up? What is the purpose? And what do we do to ourselves when we do that? We've seen this in the Supreme Court, and there is some hope here in the Supreme Court jurisprudence around juveniles that has built on some of the death penalty stuff. And basically, because you can't execute kids anymore, the most severe punishment for kids is life without parole. And it's really important to understand what that means, right? Life without parole, we say it, but it means life without the possibility of parole. It means that you are 16 years old. We think that you have done something so bad that we will sentence you to die in prison, and you'll never have a chance to reevaluate that. No, you'll never be able to get a parole hearing. You'll never be able to get back into court. It's over. The Supreme Court has basically come to the point where they have said that should be extremely rare, if ever given, because if you're going to tell us that a kid needs life without parole, you need to show that they are irreparably depraved, you need to show that, or irredeemably depraved, irreparably mm-hmm. corrupt, that they will never change. And you can't do that when someone is 16 years old. So they haven't gotten rid of
well, now with brain research, yeah, with brain research saying that we're not adults until, well, I guess whenever we leave the home, which can be in your 30s now. No, but the question I have is, you know, for those who hang on to the notion that the death penalty needs to be enforced from time to time when you do have someone who shows such a depravity, a serial killer, or whatever it may be, and it will act as a deterrent. And that's right. kind of the lingering last vestige where somebody will say, yeah, but I want to deter, and this person, if he's dead, is not going to commit another crime. How do you respond to that when you hear that, Brooks?
So that's I would only push back on one thing, is that I don't think that everybody wants it for deterrent. I definitely think there are people who want it for pure retribution. And I can't argue with that. If you believe in pure retribution, that's, you know, you believe in pure retribution. I think that some people feel that way. The deterrence piece, the evidence, there's just not evidence that the death penalty deters crime. There was a recent study of 11 countries that abolished the death penalty. After they abolished, the murder rate went down in 10 of the 11. At the local level, and I'm trying to pull up, I have the stats here, just a minute. It's also been, I think, in a large number of the jurisdictions, the states have abolished. Abolishing the death penalty has not increased the murder rate. There's been a lot, it's obviously a difficult thing to study, but the data just is not there to show that it deters crime, and in some ways makes it look like it goes in the other direction. You know, if you had data showing it deterred crime, that would be at least a piece of the argument, but we just don't have that data.
Right. Well, Brooks Emanuel from the Justice Collaborative, very interesting conversation with you today, and I thank you so much for delving into the federal, the state, criminal justice reform. Very, very informative. Thank you for coming by today on America Trends.
Thanks so much for having me, and thanks for wanting to talk about these topics. I think they're really important.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers over 40 years of experience in a broad base of services from accounting and tax to cybersecurity, technology, and transaction advisory. Bloom's experts will